It is great to be here, and I was going to start by saying that not all Queenslanders take their clothes off in winter. Sometimes we put some on, and I was going to put my jumper on. My Anzac Day jumper, signed by Daniel Rich, champion son of the king. All right, and Morrow, I've got to say, my all-time favourite player, the Eagles didn't take because they said he was too slow. He went on to play and win three premierships, a Brownlow, Norm Smith medal. His name is Simon Black, and another champion son of the king. And like Daniel Black, a East Fremantle boy, who is now true and true Queenslander, married a Brizzy girl who's a lawyer, and Brisbane is home for him. And we interviewed him at our shed recently, and we did one interview that night. In the first half of the interview, we talked footy, and then we did question and answers, and then the second half, we talked about being a bloke. And I had the privilege of doing Daniel's pre-marriage, so I got to know Daniel really well. And Daniel in public is quite a reserved guy, but he's one of those guys, you know, calm waters run deep. He takes his time to think about stuff. And I asked Daniel about the men in his life. He talked about his two grandfathers and his dad. And one of his grandfathers had lost a leg, still turned up to every one of his junior footy games, and was loved by all the boys. And I said to him, what did you learn about being a bloke from your granddads and your dad? And he said this. He said, how to treat and respect women. Isn't that good? Yeah, well, he was asked that question. What I was asked, you know, you seem to kick the ball effortlessly. And he said, yeah, if I try too hard, it doesn't go straight. So I just take it nice and gentle, and he can still kick it 60, 70 metres. You know, I'm always amazed at how good God is, because, you know, Morrow and I have not met face-to-face until yesterday. And, you know, what he was talking about yesterday and this morning just fits in beautifully. And Paul, when he wrote his letter to the Ephesians, the first half is about who we are in Christ. And wasn't that fantastic to finish that session with? Who we are in Christ. The second half is about application. And so I get to do the application bit today. I'm going to take who we are in Christ and apply it. But before we do that, okay, I want to share a couple of things a bit about me, so you get to know me just a little, because some of you blokes know me, some of you don't. And so let me tell you a bit about professionally. I started my life as a high school teacher. I taught manual arts in Queensland, or design and technology, so that's woodwork, metalwork, graphics, and phys ed. And I was a year nine specialist, and if you understand year nines, just look at your 14-year-old sons. I worked with them for 7 years. When I started teaching, I was working with 90 of them. When I finished teaching 7 years later, I was working with 180 of them, and that's why I went on to become a psychotherapist. All right. But it was a highlight working with them. I just love them. And I still got contact with guys that I taught back. In my last 2 years of teaching, they said, we want to give you a hand-selected class of 18 boys. You know which ones they chose? All the troublemakers. And I had them for 2 years, and I had the privilege of a guy coming to a seminar. I was doing a public seminar, and this big bloke, Indigenous bloke, with his big beard, he comes up with his little voice. He goes, you remember me? And I'm going like, nope. Oh, Mark Williams is mate. Nope. First bloke you gave the strap to. Holy shit. Holy shit. He said, I just came, I wanted to chat with you. His dad was a dock worker. He said, me and my brothers were feral. When I had kids, I thought, I don't want to be like my kids. Who can I be like? And he said, I remember Mr. J. And then he came along to another parenting seminar and brought his wife to introduce. So, you know, that's the impact we have. I left teaching. I worked for Scripture Union Queensland as a schools worker, working in 38 high schools in the southern suburbs, Brisbane and Logan City. Logan City is a bit like Sydney's West. Pretty tough area, and I ran camps. And in the 6 years of working for SU in ministry with a young family, I calculated I was away the equivalent of one whole year on camp. While doing that, I started a master's degree, so I really do need therapy. Did a master's degree in social sciences, majoring in counselling, and I have a counselling practice in Brisbane. We have four on the team. Tomo's, who's here. Tomo, stand up so people can see who you are. Tomo is in my practice, and Tomo's a champion. He's a school counsellor at Faith Faith Lutheran at the Redlands, where we run Red Shed. We're in our second year. And then I lecture, so I've been in my 19th year of lecturing. And probably most people know me in Brisbane because of Talking Life. I've been doing radio for 15 years. It's a life issues program, Sunday night, 2 hours, one topic, in depth. You can listen online. Gets replayed right around the country at different times. Done over 630 programs. And so coming back up in a few weeks' time, I'm going to be talking about Alzheimer's and the rates of Alzheimer's expected to double in 20 years. And so that's huge. I love talking about that stuff. I want to just give you a read an email I got from one of my students. And my student was reflecting on my class that we just finished. We had the last lecture the other week. And she said, how am I feeling right now? Relieved, excited, a little sad about a wonderful season being over, yet anticipating good things ahead. Very privileged and blessed to have been impacted by this unit and by Peter and Jenny. Jenny's my tutor. Who would have thought that a swearing, whiskey-drinking, confrontational man would make such a huge positive impact on my life? She's talking about me. So I'll read that to you again. Who would have thought that a swearing, whiskey-drinking, confrontational man would make such a huge positive impact in my life? I can imagine God chuckling to himself about it. He's also someone who loves God and his family passionately and is willing to make a stand for what is true and right and has a passion for God's incredible grace and lordship of Christ. I know I'll personally never be the same again. I'm going to get to that in a minute. Yeah, and so she's 50 years young, Christian, growing up in the church, and her life's been transformed by one thing, authenticity, by being real, right? And what I want to say just briefly is that one of the things that we've done in the church is we love to talk about the church as a family, and we love to romanticize it as the ideal family. But the truth is, the vast majority of families are dysfunctional. Why don't we talk about the church as a dysfunctional family? Isn't it? But we don't want to be honest like that. And I've been talking about this, and I get, you know, people saying I'm a church hater and a pastor hater, and don't invite him to your church because you'll probably swear and offend somebody. And I go, let's get real. You know, I say to my counselling students, you know, in the counselling room, poo doesn't cut it. When somebody's in the shit of life, you don't, I'm sorry that you're in the poo of life. Huh? Come on, when you're in the shit of life, you're in the shit. Little story, a couple came to see me for counselling. They were in the real shits. She was a Christian, he wasn't. At the end of the session, I said, would it be okay if I pray? And she's gone, yeah, pray, pray. And I said, I'm not asking, you're not asking him. He was a mature age student studying law. And I said, is it okay with you or I pray? He said, oh yeah. I said, no, that's not good enough, I won't pray. He said, no, it's really okay. So I said, let's pray. God, this couple's in deep shit, meet them in the shit, amen. He looked up, his face lit up, and he said to his wife, now that's a prayer I get. A decade later, he gave his life to the Lord. Had the privilege of seeing him and his kids, and he said, you know, that prayer was a starting of some questioning for him because someone chose to be real with him. My wife texted me this morning. Actually, I'll save that for a minute. Book being a bloke, co-authored that with Michael Knight. Let me explain how the book is written. The book is written for non-Christians primarily. It's a Christian book that's not a Christian book. It's written for Aussie blokes. It's about how to be a bloke. It's really simple. It's easy to read. Non-readers read it because the beginning of the chapter is in the words of an ordinary bloke. So one of my mates, like Sean Hart, he wrote a chapter. ABC radio personality in Brisbane, Phil Smith, wrote it in the beginning. And then there's some blokes you won't know. So there's one page, which is a bloke story. Then there's one and a bit page, which is a bullet point summary of the book. Then there's the chapter. Then you go to the end of the chapter and tells you what to do. So really, if you want to, you only need to read 4 pages in a chapter to get the guts of the book. Somebody asked if I was going to ask quarter of the price. publishers don't do that, okay? All right. And it's a book that you can give to non-Christians. It is a really easy, and I've got great feedback from non-Christians reading the book. And So it really touches their lives. I'm a mad keen fisherman. Surf fishing is one of my passions. And there's a few blokes here who come to Fraser with us in my community. And men, we've been going to Fraser for nearly 30 years fishing. Bit of paradise up there. Tell me about my family. We have normal family photos. When I was here last time, I talked about some of the struggles with narrowly being a survivor of breast cancer. May last year, she was declared in full remission. And she is such a classy lady that to celebrate taking her last pill, we actually had a morning tea at Sarah May Winery, and she took her last pill with champagne. Isn't that class? Okay. That's classy. And Moro, like you, you know, she enables me to do so much. And hey, spooning is great. All right. And spooning this lady, we're going to grow old together because we look death face on, and we decided that we actually need to start not waiting till retirement to tick off our bucket list. Let's start doing it now. I mentioned my youngest daughter, that's Beck. She's 25. Moro, I empathise with your daughter. This one's cut from the cloth of her old man. In fact, she's a teacher doing a master's degree. She's caused me incredible grief over the years of life, but now that her frontal cortex of her brain has matured, she is an amazing woman, and she is marrying an amazing man who I am delighted to be calling my son-in-law. And in fact, when they started hanging out as friends, I kept saying to Nerily, he should just give up and propose now because I'm praying. All right. He doesn't know that yet. I'm going to get him to watch the video. Hey. My oldest daughter, Kate, is married to Wes. I'm going to come back to that for a moment. I want to just stick with Nerily for a moment. Nerily sent me a text this morning very early. May God use you mightily today so that men become men that can grow up, stand firm, and be honouring to him, themselves, and their wives. Love you heaps, even though I whinge sometimes. I truly believe God has given you an amazing gift. So proud of you. Miss you heaps. Kiss, kiss, kiss. Maybe even what I might grow up one day. Laugh out loud.
That's a real prayer.
That's a real prayer, isn't it? What an amazing woman. Okay. So I've got to go back to my intro notes. Okay. I'm going to be talking about growing emotional muscle, and I'm going to talk about robust communication and about getting a grip on our brains. And the reason I'm going to do that is because the things that challenge emotional growth the most is marriage and parenting. And yet we've bought the romanticized myth that boy meets girl, kiss, live happily ever after. That's why it sells so much, because it's not true. And if we're going to be good fathers and if we're going to be good husbands, we actually need to really grow some muscle. And here's the thought. God, back in the garden, created a perfect family in a perfect world, and guess what his kids did? They still stuffed up. And how many times when our kids stuff up, we want to beat ourselves up? But the perfect father with the perfect family in the perfect world still had family issues. Ponder that one for a moment. All right? Sideline thing that I just want to pick up really quickly. Yesterday, during the electives, we nicked out and went to the War Memorial. And the reason being is that Rex, who's first time here at Better Blokes, and Rex is my brother from another mother. Where's DJ? Where are you, Dave? Stand up. This is my baby brother. This is my little brother. Okay? He's 11 years younger than me, but what I said, he hears similar tones in the voice. But I love that man passionately, and he's got three daughters. And his oldest is going to be maid of honour for my daughter's wedding at Easter, and they're pretty close.
I think also we've got probably more genetics here than Lishy's.
Probably. Yeah, there is. Yeah. And where's Cousin John? Hey, Cousin John, he hasn't got his slippers on, but when I first met Cousin John back in 1992 on Giraffe, when I messed with his head as well as a whole heap of other farming boys who wanted to beat the crap out of me, they actually had planned that I would walk out of the room, though one was going to grab me and the rest were going to lay into me, because I helped them confront some stuff they didn't want to confront. He was wearing some Ugg boot slippers. He was wearing them yesterday just for me, okay? He's still got same pair, hey? Anyway, Rex was clearing up some stuff at his mum's place and he found a letter from Gallipoli, handwritten from a relative to a cousin. And so part of going to the war memorial yesterday was so Rex could actually submit the letter to the war memorial. And while I was at the war memorial, we were walking around and there was one of those models and it was the Western Front of the guys going forward. And what caught my eye was two diggers were bending down to pull guys up. They turned their back to the enemy to grab their mate and lift their mate out of the trench. And one of the guys had his back bent so his mate could stand on his back to get up out of the trench. And I said to Rex, there we go, brothers in arms. Brothers in arms. All right, now we might go on about footy teams, but you know, when it comes to war, who cares about states? And I say to our Kiwi brothers, or I should say bros, Kiwi bros, is that, you know, when it's footy, we're enemies. But when it comes to the trenches, are we not brothers in arms? Yeah. And so there's a great history there. So let me just get my little device here so I can see where I'm up to. All right. Going to start with a clip.
What are you doing this weekend?
I'm putting up a retaining wall.
Doing it yourself?
No, I'm going to get some broken.
Oh, come on, mate. Do it yourself.
She's pretty big job.
Oh, you'll be right.
You reckon?
We can knock it over in half a day.
Yeah.
Get a couple mates around.
Hey, Josie!
Huh?
Give us a hammer for job Saturday.
Mate, you're dreaming.
Aussies.
Oh, no surprises here.
DIY. It's in our DNA.
Okay, we all grow old, but not all grow up. And I love talking to guys at schools level. I say, you know what, growing up's not optional on the outside. We all grow old. Growing old's not optional. Growing up on the inside is optional. And the worst and most unbecoming thing to a woman is a little boy in a man's body. But we don't grow up on the inside because we're not taught. And we learn it from blokes. And so I'm going to talk about this thing called emotional immaturity. And emotional immaturity is really interesting. Oh, it's not responding on the clicker. Just, John, can you just click it up for me? Don't know what's happening there. Oh, you probably need to touch back on your screen. That's it. Babies are cute, but they make lousy leaders. And the reason emotional maturity is about feeling insignificant and insecure. And yet what Morrow did with the closing thing was about, we've got no reason to be insecure, but you know, most of us are. And guess what? The moment you get married, this beautiful woman that you want presses all your insecurity buttons. Because guess what? If you're going to be intimate, and I'm not talking sex, I'm talking if she's going to know you, she's going to know every one of your faults. And she's going to point them out to you. And in fact, Gary Thomas says this, if you want to serve Jesus, stay single. If you want to become like Jesus, get married. Because she will be a full-length dress mirror reflecting every one of your faults back in your face. Marriage and fathering presses buttons of insignificance and insecurity, which is about emotional immaturity. Now, long time ago when I was here, I just put up this little diagram. So on one end with the spectrum, we've got emotional constipation, which is a lot of Aussie blokes. So they don't want to have feelings, so they put on their suit of armour. Now think about this for a moment. Most Aussie blokes wear their suit of armour. They go to bed with it on. She's lying next to him, hearing his heartbeat, wanting to get to his heartbeat, banging up against the suit of armour, but it's cold, it's hard, it's abrasive. She can't get to the heart, I mean, because, hey, come on, we're good Lutherans. We've got German stock. We don't feel nothing. We live with our thinking. Heaven forbid if we be emotional, but it's not just Lutherans. Presbyterians, Anglicans, Catholics. I go to a Baptist church, they're equally as bad, all right, except for they spiritualize their constipation, okay? It's called a spiritual defense mechanism. Because somehow we're not going to touch our feelings. And, you know, you could be British, it's stiff upper lip. You go anywhere in the world, it's like this. On the other end is emotional diarrhea, which is I'm overrun by emotions. So when the storms of life hit me, it's like I'm drowning in the emotion. And I can't, got to panic. And it's out of control because it's all feeling. What if I need to be emotionally maturity, which is I actually feel my emotions, but I'm not controlled by them. And I have this capacity to have deep roots that are solid to know who I really am. And when the storms of life come and buffet me, I don't fall over because I have the capacity to think and feel at the same time. That is emotional maturity, to think and feel at the same time. And that's not easy. But I'm going to give you some tools to do that today, all right? All right. So this is a really important concept. What happens on the outside of us in all our relationships in marriage, our relationships with our kids, our relationships with our mates, our relationship with God, what happens on that outside, which a technical word is interpersonal, is directly related to what happens on the inside. And just bear with me because my voice keeps crashing here for some reason and I'm just going to go a different way. Dr. David Banner said this, my relationship with God and others stands or falls on my relationship with myself. The slides will be available, they'll be up on the website. So let me put this into a diagram, being a visual bloke, okay? So she sends a message, he picks it up, that has some sort of impact on him. That stirs something. You know the button pushing of insecurity and insignificance? And so if she says something and she might roll her eyes in a certain way and all of a sudden I feel disrespect, so then I actually roar up at her and she perceives that and then that does something about her and stirs her. And most conflicts in relationship has got nothing to do with communication. It's actually got to do with what's going on the inside of us. And I have couples who come to counselling who say, oh, we've got bad communication. I go, oh, really? And yeah, he just says, she nags all the time and, you know, she just won't communicate properly. And then she goes, oh, and he goes, oh. And I go, you guys look like you're communicating really well to me. True? How many of us can look across the room and have our wife look at us and we know the 1,000 words that go with that look? How many of us? Come on, let's be honest. Okay, thank you. Is that a communication problem? No. That is not a communication problem. And it's not about skills of communication. And I'm going to restart my device while I talk. It's not about the skills of communication. David Snyder says this. The problem is you can have the best skills in communication in the world and they don't work if you don't want to hear the message. It's not about the communication skills. It's about hearing the message. Now, here's the catch. What if her message pushes my buttons of insecurity and insignificance? Do I want to hear that? Do I want to say, thank you, honey, for the enlightenment of telling me where I've actually just behaved like an immature 5-year-old? You're so insightful, and thank you for being invested in my personal growth. Nah, not like that at all. It's like, how dare you say that about me? And in the backs of my brain is going, you're supposed to love me and adore me no matter what I do. Why are you actually picking on me and putting me down? See, we don't go to the right places. So, I'm going to share some helpful understandings and then I'm going to share some tools on the relationship toolbox, which I'm going to be putting into a book. Okay, so tension isn't given. Any relationship, you're going to have tension. If you've got a relationship that's not had tension, just check your pulse that you're not dead. Or maybe the other person's dead. Oh, hang on. But there are those who are dead on the inside who are walking around in our churches and haven't had the courtesy to lie down yet. I warned you. Swearing, whiskey, drinking, confronting man. That's right. And Wayne was at a thing I did at Hillsong in Brisbane this year. They did a marriage course and they invited me to come and talk about sex. Very dangerous thing. So we started with Song of Song and we got very explicit, didn't we, mate? Still recovering. So I'm not going to give you that PowerPoint, but when I say to my wife, the stag wants to visit the garden and sup on wine all night. Do you get the idea? It is erotic graphic literature. Well, I think the penis wants to go to the vagina and just soak up erotic love all night. Amen. And I've been saying to her just lately, I say, your armpits are like a smooth highway to the mountains of pleasure. See, she's a special lady. She's married to me, you know. Anyway, what happens when tension happens in our relationships, most of us default to going, I want to reduce the tension. We don't like tension. And in fact, many of us have grown up with this romanticized family belief about the family of God that if there's tension, there's something wrong. The fact is, tension is something right. We live in a fallen, screwed up world. Romans 8 says this, the whole world is out of kilter and it's groaning like a woman in childbirth waiting for its deliverance. And we think we should have a peaceful, harmonious life. The whole world is out of whack. Tension's inevitable. It's what you do with it. And when we reduce the tension, basically we give up. We say, leave me alone. I'm happy to live in my insecurity and insignificance. Leave me alone. I'm happy to stay where I'm at. Leave me alone. I want to be a five-year-old on the inside. And in fact, I'll throw my sophisticated man-like tantrums, but they're still tantrums, so that you get the message to leave me alone. The alternative is, what if I actually embrace the tension and do some growth? Now, here's all the experts in the field say this. Marriage, the number one purpose of marriage is to grow us up. It is not to make us happy. C.S. Lewis said it, all the researchers say it, and to go with Gary Chapman says, what if God designed marriage not to make us happy, but rather to make us holy? See, marriage is a sanctification process. And when we embrace growth, we get happy. So shit happens. So it happens to all of us, happens to me. I don't have a charmed life, but I have a life that gives me an opportunity to grow in sanctification, to grow in holiness, and to grow in maturity. So these tools are tools that I use every day. Let me talk about tension reduction. It's about perceived threat and survival. So your brain, which is part of the central nervous system, is sitting there going like crazy. You're sitting there now, and some of you are actually, what you're doing is that you're taking in information, so you're actually listening to me. Some of you are actually not even aware that you're going, oh, my temperature's going up. You just get hot. Your digestive system's working, and then your body's also responding and monitoring and regulating. So if I'm hot, I better take that jumper off, or I'm a bit uncomfortable, I have a wriggle. This is going on, a gazillion bits of information all the time. But what happens with the brain is that the radar of threat is up all the time. And if I perceive a threat, then I go to tension reduction because that's how we survive. And we talk about fight, flight, freak and freeze. I'm going to talk about that more. That's a survival mechanism. So I'm going to give you a second understanding about how that works with the brain. And I'm going to talk about three parts of the brain there, all right? Let me tell you the first part of the brain, which is around the brainstem and that big bally bit at the back here called the cerebellum. This is the automatic brain. So it's first to develop in utero. So once your kids are in pregnant, that's the first part of the brain to develop. It's the fastest part of the brain. It runs everything that we don't think about. Digestion, blood pressure, heart rates, everything. Everything we need to survive. If that stops working, you're dead. Simple as that. Second part of the brain wraps around that, which is called the impulsive brain. Well, for those who are a bit more technical, we talk about this as the limbic system. And John Anderson asked me last night about the amygdala. The amygdala is the control part of this. And this part of the brain is the emotional experiential brain. By the way, women have a bigger amygdala than us, which explains why they're more emotional and relational. Okay? Now, what does this part of the brain do? This is dominant up to about age 4. So if you've had a terrible experience, let's say as a little tacker, you get bailed up by a dog, that's embedded in this part of the brain. So then the antenna apps all the time, where's the threatening dog? Where's the threatening dog? And you can live your whole life where you might hear a growling dog and all of a sudden you go, because it's in this part of the brain. And this part of the brain is the second part of the brain. It's dominant up to about age 4. That's why we can't remember memories before 4. It runs on experience and emotions. Its fear is its biggest trigger. It fires up our defense mechanisms and it learns by repetition. And I say to teachers that I work with is that about 1,000 repetitions to write neural pathways. We talk about neuroplasticity. We can change it, but old habits are hard to change. I talk about wheel ruts. When I'm dealing with people who have experienced trauma from early life, is that they have these deep wheel ruts that their response slides into the wheel rut. And Rex's wife was sharing with me about they were walking around somewhere in old Rome in Italy, and she said, here are the wheel ruts still from the chariots. And she remembers me talking about this, and she said, oh, wow, if they're deep ruts, I wonder what they're like in the brain. All right. Now, this part, when it lights up, it's linked to your adrenal glands, which controls your defense mechanisms. Okay, the next part of the brain is the smart brain. It's a prefrontal cortex, what happens is it's the last part of the brain to develop. Doesn't come on till really about puberty, doesn't mature till 21 to 25, earlier in girls, later in boys. So just remember, when you've got a 14-year-old son, you want to go, don't you have a brain? No, he's only got 70% of a brain. Didn't you think? What were you thinking? Well, he wasn't. That part of the brain hadn't engaged. You know, we say some really dumb stuff as parents, don't we? You know? Now, it's the slowest part of the brain. Helps us think through decisions. It's the first to switch off under stress. Get that. Do you know when you have an argument and you walk away and go, did I really say that? That's because your smart brain switches off when you're under stress. It has the power to override the impulsive brain, but most times it goes offline. So it's a real issue. So just to play this out for you, I'll give you an illustration before I play it out. Schoolies Week is a big issue in Queensland. And so we have, 50,000 kids going down to, and we've got all these young blokes. There's about 500 unplanned pregnancies a year at Schoolies Week. Because, our high school boys, these 17, 18-year-old boys are told to go be a man. How do you be a man? You drink copious amounts of alcohol. You behave like a goose. You shag whichever girl you can, and that makes you a man. Bom, bom. Now, what happens is, if you look at this stuff around the brain, is that they take in alcohol. The body says too much alcohol, so the first thing it does to survive is it switches off the smart brain. That's why they do dumb stuff. Because their smart brain switched off because of alcohol as a survival mechanism. Then if they keep drinking, the impulsive brain switches off and they become comatose because it's going to put all the blood and brain energy into the automatic brain to keep them alive. That is the survival mechanism of the brain. But the same process works without alcohol. It works in relationships. So this is where you get it. Okay, so what happens is, I'll do this summary first. So smart brain is explicit memory. It's autobiographical, facts, details, locked in a time and history, you recall it. If I said, what did you do? If you were here last year, what was Better Blokes last year? What did Morrow talk about? You'd go to this part of your brain and go, oh yeah, we talked about this, this and this. Now, what would happen is as you talk about it, it will trigger the impulsive brain, which has all the effect, and go, oh yeah, it was really good, and all of a sudden you got feelings of warmth and oh, that was great, and remember we laughed about this, and so the impulsive brain can never be recalled, it's only triggered. And remember, repetition. Yep. Huge. Yep. Yep. Your five senses are your triggers for this. Okay, so let's come back to footballers for a moment. Repetition, 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 repetition. So the trigger is, this is coming, I see this coming and I respond. They don't even have to think about it with their conscious brain. It's all impulsive brain automatic stuff. Now, so it goes like this. When my impulsive brain fires up, my smart brain switches off. Let's put that to pictures. Okay, there's a big threat in the distant. and the threat gets a bit closer and my impulsive brain lights up. The threat gets closer, my impulsive brain lights up. All of a sudden, my smart brain switches off and my impulsive brain goes into overload. And so then what happens is I go into fight. I'm ready for the biff. Or I go into flight. I'm going to run away. Or I'm going to freak out. I have a panic attack on the inside. Or I'm going to freeze, lie down and play dead, and hopefully they'll leave me alone. But we're really elaborate with this. Now, get this. Let's say as a kid, I learnt to flight, withdraw. So Nerilee wants to point out something that triggers my five-year-old part of my insecurity and significance. And when she wants to talk about it, every time I run away, as a defense mechanism, it's pretty good when somebody's going to thump you. But an intimate relationship, it's not very productive, is it? And so part of the issue of growing up to be emotionally mature men is that in our relationships with our wives, with our kids, with our mates, is we've got to learn to actually decode some of the threats, catch our impulsive brain reactions and slow it down and change it. That's called growth. Oh, hang on, I've got to go back on this clip. Can we just, John, just pause that for a minute? You might have to play that. This explains impulsive brain. You don't need to hear anything. There's just music background. Just watch the clip because you'll get impulsive brain. Will that play?
I fell in love with you the first time I looked into their eyes. You got a certain little cute way of flirting with their eyes. They make me feel so happy. They make me feel so blue. Fought on a solid, fought in a great big way for you. My heart is jumping, you should have stopped at something with them, their eyes.
You like that one, guys? Hey, what do you reckon his conversation to himself is afterwards? You goose! This chick's winning on you and you belt her over the head with your paper! What a moron! Now, let's unpack this for a moment. I grew up in a housing commission house. I'm one of five. I'm the second oldest. Our older brother is profoundly deaf. So I had to share a room with two brothers in a housing commission house. We were the kids that nobody wanted to play with because their parents said, don't play with those Janetsky kids. And so space was really difficult and having your own things was really important because you didn't have a lot that was your own. And what if for him, he didn't have much of his own? And what if he had brothers who took his books and wrote on his books? And what if he actually had a prize pay book that he won at school and his brother wrote in it? And he's sitting down reading, this is my paper. And she comes along and picks up her lipstick and writes it in a nice gesture and it triggers all that stuff back to when he was a little tacker that his brother wrote on his book, how dare you write on my book? Bang! Do you think he's aware of that? No. But maybe that's what's going on inside of his head. But he just walks away and goes, what a goose, I belted a nice woman on the head with a paper. Huh? Yeah. Yeah. So, helpful concept number three is this, is that we have this thing called the impulsive brain and procedural learning. Procedural learning and procedural memory does not involve conscious thought. So what happens is talking, walking, playing a musical instrument, sports, riding a bike, driving a car, and our responses to perceived threats are procedural learns. And so procedural learned is by repetition. You don't think about it. It's automatic. How many times you get in the car, you don't even look to put the key in. You get where you're going and go, oh, how did I get here? You know, you're on automatic pilot. That's procedural learning. And our defense mechanisms are also part of our procedural learning. So we bring all of that to our relationships. And if my procedural learning dominates in an unhealthy way because I've not grown up in maturity, then I'll have immature responses in my relationships. Helpful understanding number four, emotional maturity involves It involves this. One, managing my impulsive brain and engaging my smart brain so that I change my procedural learning and respond from a position of emotional security, not reactivity. Have a good look at that and absorb that. Just take a moment. Emotional maturity involves managing my impulsive brain and engaging my smart brain so that I change my procedural learning and respond from a position of emotional security, not reactivity. I teach this to blokes in counselling and they don't even know that because they don't need to know it with their smart brain. They need to just know it with their whole brain and do it. Doesn't matter whether they can articulate it or not. If they stop reacting and start responding, they're doing it. Okay, but because of this, as a teaching format, it's helpful to have it up there. Okay, so tools from the relationship toolbox. Actually, no, I'm going to, I've got enough time, I'm just going to chuck that. I'm going to go back. Hey, take a moment, chat to the guys next to you about that for a moment, and talk about what's grabbed you thus far. What is it that stood out for you thus far? If you need to stand up and have a stretch, stand up, have a stretch, have a wriggle. Couple of minutes to quickly chat. Go for it. Thanks, guys. Always dangerous when you say to blokes, start talking. Often blokes, they take a little while to warm up, but once you get them going, it's really good. I'm going to give you six tools. Most of them are interrelated. I'm going to say they're simple, but they're not easy. I'm still working on them, okay? So let me go to tool number one out of the toolbox, okay? First thing is you've got to connect and understand before responding. My clinical supervisor is Dr. John Waller. He's a psychiatrist, and he's the developer of the Christian wholeness approach to counselling, and he does this in small groups. He does it in churches. We talk about the five steps of cure. So the first step is if you're going to journey with someone, you've got to connect. Second thing you've got to do is understand. The third one is then respond, and fourth is engage help. Now, which step is the church really good at and goes to first? The response step. So we don't even really understand what's going on, let alone connect deeply to go. And what makes shed so powerful is because we do lots of connecting and understanding and we don't do any responding because the response comes out of the understanding. Make sense? Now, guess what? Us blokes are really good because our brains have 100 differences to chicks' brains. Guess what we're really good at doing? Responding. She starts to go, blah, 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 let me fix it. And she doesn't give a rip about us fixing it. We might come up with a life-changing, world-shattering solution to this problem, and it doesn't matter because all she wants us to do is to connect and understand. Now, our brains are so wide that we've got to go to fix, 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 fix. So the first thing is you've got to learn to connect and understand. And I say to myself all the time, connect and understand. Neryl even says to me, do I have to book an appointment to sit in the counselling room so you'll listen to me? Yes. Oh, don't worry, she's the practice manager. Hey. She's my PA and practice manager. Okay, so second tool is when my impulsive brain is triggered, you must stop reacting. And I've got to tell you, I react like a pork chop, all right? My mum is Mackenzie, Highland Scottish. So when I get triggered, I don't do withdrawal. I want to put on the bagpipes, put on my kilt, pull out my sword and say, hey, I'm going to war. And she goes, run away, run away, run away. And I have to stop doing that. And I have to stop taking everything personally, right? We do this so all the time. When I'm on radio, if somebody rings in and goes, Janetsky, you're a dickhead, you know what I do? I press a button and it goes beep, 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 beep. And I say to myself, thank you for your enlightened opinion. But if I walk home that night, it's through the front door, I get into home about 11:30 at night, 11:45, and Neroli says, I was listening to radio tonight, which he really doesn't. Let's say, you know that caller who called you a dickhead? I agree with him. What do you think my response is? Now, what if she's got a valid point? Or what if she's just had a really crappy night and she's cranky? But I can't find out because I will react and I will personalize because that means you don't love me, I'm not important. So it goes straight to the insignificance, insecurity buttons. Do you see that? So then I need to stop and breathe because 2 minutes of regulated appropriate breathing can turn off your adrenal system. 2 minutes. And adrenaline is one molecule different to cocaine. That's why it's so addictive and you don't pay cash for it. Right? But if you slow it down and breathe, you'll calm down. And then you need to get out of the wheel rut of saying, this is what I normally do. But that actually requires some little movement from the impulsive brain to the smart brain to go, uh-oh, something's going on. I'm going to share a ripper of a story with you a little later about it. Okay? Okay. Tool number three, engage my smart brain. So once I've stopped reacting and being a pork chop, then I need to go and reflect, clarify, and understand. So for me, I call a timeout. Nerilee gives me this look. She's got this look down pat now. And when she gives me this look, I go, uh-oh, frontal cortex meltdown, impulsive brain overload. I'm going away. And I go out into my garden. Oh, I go fishing. And I start to reflect and go, what was that about for me? Not what was about her. But see, we're always the expert. Hey, I'm a therapist. I am the world's best expert on Nerilee. I can tell you everything about what's going on in her life and issues. But there's only one problem. I can't change her. I can only change moi. And so if I reflect, if I clarify, if I seek to understand what's going on for me, then we can start to address. Tool number four. You have to choose to respond from the best in me. Let me put this a different way. You have a choice to operate from the lowest common denominator or the highest common denominator. And in Ephesians, Paul calls us to be servant leaders to our wives and children. Can we operate from the highest common denominator even when our wife and our kids and our work colleagues are operating from the lowest as a bunch of pork chops? Can we actually go, I'm going to operate out of the best of me and be the man that God made me? Can I take what Morrow said and internalize that and hold that for my security and my significance and operate as the way the scriptures describe me? That's easy to say with your smart brain, but notice where I'm talking about from in here. Comes out my pores, and I need to actually work really hard. Now, this is a percentage game before you get guilt tripped, okay? If you're operating from the lowest common denominator and you do it, switch it to the highest common denominator once out of 10 and you haven't done it, that's progress. Then if you do it a second time out of 10, you've just doubled your progress. And if you keep chipping away, sooner or later, you'll do it more often than not, but you won't get it perfect, okay? If you're batting around 70, 80%, you're doing really, really well. Okay, tool number five, this thing called communication tennis. So you've got to get better understanding. Notice there, better understanding. So what do you got to do? Listen, listen and listen. But what happens is smart brain goes off the line, impulsive brain goes up, and all of a sudden my brain's thinking three times faster than I hear, and she says something and I've got about five retorts already before she's even finished the sentence. Wow, that's good listening. Not. Hardest person in the world for me to listen to is my wife and kids. Hardest ones. So I'm going to give you this thing called communication tennis, which we do. So communication tennis goes like this. One, you've got to make a time when it's ready to talk. So I say to Nerilee, are you ready to talk about this issue? I've clarified I need to talk about this issue. Are you happy to talk about it? Secondly, we're going to be really clear. For some people, I say write it on a piece of paper. John Warlow, who developed this, the first time he did it, he got a piece of masking tape. They wrote the issue on a ping pong ball and used the ping pong ball to actually do this and wrote it so they stayed on task. Second thing is you've got to decide who talks first, who serves, like in tennis. So the receiver only listens. Your only reply is this. This is what I heard you say, blah, blah, blah. Have I got it right? It doesn't matter whether you agree, disagree, like or dislike. In fact, I don't give a rip whether you agree or disagree or like or dislike, because that's a response step. We've got to do a understanding step. But it's not about winning the argument. It's not about who's right or wrong. It's about, let me really hear you. And Neroli and I, we're so different in our personalities. In our early marriage, we get to the end of argument and realize we're arguing the same point, just from different perspectives. And we spent an hour and a half. Huh? Really dumb stuff. Wish I knew this a long time ago. Then the server gets to clarify. So as per step, so Neroli says, no, you got this bit right, this bit wrong. So I go, okay, have I heard you right this time? Have I got that right? And if you're doing this for the first time, you might want to let them do five serves and then all till they're heard, and then you switch it. Then it's the other person's to go, oh, okay, this is what I think. It's really fun in counseling, because when I used to do this with tennis balls, I had a pink ball and a blue ball, and I'd say, okay, we're going to start with one ball, toss a coin, and they'd have to actually, pink ball, we're talking about her side, so they'd end up throwing at each other. Because this takes real maturity. Because when you start to do this, guess what? All your tantrums come to the fore because I'm right. Can't you get that I'm right? It's not about being right. Should never be about being right. You go, that was an ace. Have I got that right? All right. Double fault. Yeah, they might have to go back and go, what did you mean by that? Okay. Tool number six, got to use your smart brain. So I'm going to put this together a little bit. So when you stop reacting, you use a circuit breaker. The circuit breaker, you slow down and breathe, and then you come back and replay. It's a lovely thing called stop and replay. How many times does it take to build pathways in the brain? 1,000 repetitions. So stop and replay helps us to build those things. So you've got to have a circuit breaker and you've got to stop and replay. I'm going to give you an illustration in a moment, but I'm going to put it together, okay? So got to catch what's happening on the outside. So I'm sitting at my computer working one day. Daryl is in her office. She calls out and says, sweetheart, I need you to do three things, A, B, and C. I said, yeah, that's cool. No worries, A, B, and C. 30 seconds later, she says, oh, by the way, I need you to do X, Y, and Z. I got up out of my chair. I walked into her office, frontal cortex meltdown, impulsive brain overload. I went, rah! She looks at me from her desk with that look like, what are you doing, you moron? I go, uh-oh, something wrong here. Time out, we're stopping. I go out to the rainforest garden. I go, what the hell was that about? Took me about 20 minutes. I was writing a report. Now, in our marriage, I'm the person who says later. That's my favorite word. She's the person who says now. And I was writing a report. And the first three things are okay, but the second lot of three things, you know, I'm in my thought is that, doesn't this woman know she's interrupting my report writing and I've got to get this report done? It's hard enough for me to do this report now, and now she wants me to do all that stuff. It was all about personality types. So I went back after I got a grip, I clarified, I reflected, I understood. I went back, I said, sweetheart, can we replay? She said, sure. So I went back to my computer, set up my computer. She calls out from her office, sweetheart, I need you to do three things, A, B, and C. No worries. 30 seconds later, also need you to do X, Y, and Z. Smart brain kicks in. I need to clarify something here. When do you want it done by? Because I'm writing a report. She said, close of business will be okay. That's great by me, sweetie. Do you see how that works? So you've got a circuit break, you've got to manage yourself, you've got to reflect, clarify, you've got to respond out of the best of you, and then you've got to replay so that you're actually using this outside-inside interaction to change the inside so you keep changing the outside. Make sense? All right. So, you want to get a picture of that? Slides are going to be available. So I'm going to put back up here. Emotional maturity involves managing my impulsive brain and engaging my smart brain so that I change my procedural learning and respond from a position of emotional security, the best in me, not reactivity. Oh, you betcha, Shoffy. Much easier. Much easier. And yeah, it really is easy, but the comment's true. The cost is no intimacy. Okay? Because intimacy, and we talked about this when I came and talked about sexuality and relationships, intimacy is about being known. Intimacy is about being known. Now, if I need to be liked, if I need to have my insecurity and my insignificance stroked, then I can never be known. So actually the cost is I might go to some other form of cheap, easy intimacy rather than authentic intimacy, because the truth is I have to get naked to the soul with this woman so that I can actually experience intimacy. No, we've had enough of that. We've had enough of that. Hey, Chad. Okay. Chad's got his hand up. He's got his hand up. He's going home early tomorrow, so that's all right. Okay. So if I want authentic intimacy, I actually have to get a grip of I'm going to feel insecure and insignificant at times, and it's my job to fix that, not somebody else's. And the people who are closest to me are the ones who are going to press the buttons. Make sense? Okay, there's the webpage. There's a whole heap of free resources on the webpage. The video and stuff and audio go up, and the PowerPoints will be available up there. I'll also whack them on my webpage if you want the PowerPoints when I get home, so that you can actually download them, because it's really helpful to do the communication tennis to actually have the steps in front of you. And I say to couples when I'm working with them, you know what, it's going to feel weird and awkward, but do it. I got a lovely email recently. The head of the meeting is admission for the day. The email was, how do I tell Peter Janetsky the stuff he said to do really works? All right. This stuff works. Okay. I'm going to pray. Let's pray. Father God, thank you that relationships is part of your divine order. And in fact, it's more than that. It's actually part of your essential character and being. To get our head around that you're three but one, that's just what intimacy is. And our relationships with our wives, with our kids, with our mates, with our fathers, with our communities is supposed to reflect that. And yet in this stuffed up, screwed up world, we really struggle. And Lord, I want to say thank you for the things you've taught me and continue to teach me so that I can actually be the man that you made me to be and somehow taste that level of intimacy. And I want to pray for my brothers. Lord, help them to take out of today something that is practical to go, I can work on this. And to start to actually change stuff, and that our wives and our kids and our mates will go, wow, something's in your head, you're changing. And we'll be able to go, yeah, I'm growing up. And in that growing up, I'll be able to point to you and reflect you, and that others would know you just by how we live. So help us in this, I pray in your name, Jesus. Amen.